He grew up and still lives in Pascagoula, a bit east of Biloxi, and has been the center's chief of staff since 1994, which makes him an anomaly in the VA system, where the moorings of appointments rarely withstand shifts in political winds. Credit for his longevity used to be chalked up to his friendship with Trent Lott, the former Republican senator and one-time Senate Majority Leader. They grew up together in Pascagoula. But Turnbull's tenure has outlasted Lott's, so nowadays, no one knows. Still, no one disputes Dr. Turnbull's skills as a cardiac surgeon, which age doesn't seem to have blunted, nor his ferocious commitment to patient care, though some, Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas among them, grumble that his concept of patient care hasn't much evolved since his years as a combat medic in Vietnam. "It's a country vet mentality," she says. "Sew them up in the afternoon and put them back on the plow come morning. When you talk to him about holistic care, you get the feeling he's imagining an aromatherapy studio in Berkeley." Janice was on the docket, as her husband Nat had phrased it, that morning. Her first ever IQIC presentation. Everyone knew why, and since everyone wanted the inside skinny on Cameron's recovery, the presentation preceding hers, including one about a recent admittee to the ER who'd briefly but dramatically been suspected of Ebola infection, were met with impatient disinterest. "Is there any other input we could possibly get here?" asked a frustrated clinical virologist after his Ebola scare presentation to averted-eyed silence. The speed at which the meeting was progressing, however, appeared to brighten Dr. Turnbull's mood, so much so that when he called upon Janice for the morning's final case, he accorded her a wide and gleaming grin and said, "Now let's all hear about your miracle fella, Dr. Cuevas." Janice suppressed a wince. She was already rankled by the way the word miracle was being used to caulk the gaps and cracks in Cameron's story, and she showed her irritation in the tight-lipped smile she returned Dr. Turnbull. Maybe, she thought, he'd meant it ironically. After setting up her laptop for her slide component and switching on an iPhone app with which to record the presentation, she paused to survey her audience. No one was doing paperwork. Every eye was upon her. Dr. Turnbull, she noticed, was flexing his fingers and still grinning, as though anticipating entertainment. "So our patient," she began, "is a 26-year-old Caucasian male admitted to us for outpatient care continuum. He presented as a T9 Asia A with zone of partial preservation of pinprick to T12, LEM score of 0. Cause of the SCI was combat trauma, shrapnel from an IED. Date of injury, March 22, 2010. As she clicked the remote control in her hand to display some of the earliest imagery in Cameron's file, she felt the entire room craning toward her. "The shrapnel entered the body from the right paraspinal area and crossed the midline through the spinal canal. It split the T9 vertebral body. As you can see from the MRI, the posterior element was shattered and the nerve root sustained collateral damage from the burst fracture. The dura was also torn. A T9 decompression fusion was performed at Brook, but patient showed minimal sensory motor improvement even in the zone of partial preservation. But this," she went on, "is where things get really interesting." With another click of the remote, she put up a slide from Cameron's current MRI. "On August 23rd, the patient spontaneously regained lower extremity motor and sensory function." Aside from a long, "Whoa," drifting from the back of the audience, the room went silent. Can we see that first slide again?" someone shouted out. Mental exertion, Janice saw, was contorting every face, even Dr. Turnbull's. "When you say spontaneously regained," someone else asked, "I mean he stood up from his wheelchair and walked without assistance." Murmurs overtook the room, while Janice fielded a half-dozen more questions about Cameron's injury, surgery, and recovery. Frown lines began appearing as the physicians, struggling to navigate through this information, found themselves hitting blind alleys. A few shook their heads in what looked like cognitive surrender or its close cousin, amazement. "4-year spinal shock?" someone ventured, weakly enough to pass it off as a joke. A hand went up. I realize we're in unusual territory here, asked a nurse practitioner who worked in the neurology department. But are we actually in, you know, uncharted territory? Recovery from SCIs can be awfully variable. I'm just wondering if there's any precedent here. Great question, and it's why I consulted with Dr. Price, Janice replied, referring to the nurse practitioner's department head. Let me just put something on the screen here. One sec. Okay, this is data from a 2007 ICCP study examining rate of spontaneous recovery after an SCI. Onto the screen went a bar graph illustrating the percentages of paralyzed patients who'd recovered function, based on the A to E grades established by the American Spinal Injury Association's impairment scale, known as ASIA. As you can see, Janice explained, after 1 year, using the model systems, about 83% of ASIA A patients remained ASIA A, Cameron's former grade, meaning a complete absence of motor and sensory function below the injury. 9% converted to ASIA B, complete loss of motor function but incomplete sensory loss. 7% to ASIA C and 1% to ASIA D, both motor and sensory loss incomplete. But ASIA A to ASIA E, Janice went on, which was the leap Cameron had made, 0%. So, yeah, she concluded, this is way out there. What really astounds me, said an orthopedic surgeon in the front row before pausing to laugh. Well, a lot astounds me here, but one thing, I'm presuming there was significant muscle atrophy in his legs after 4 years. So then the sudden onset of mobility, I mean, even if you exclude neurogenic atrophy, 4 years of secondary disuse atrophy alone is enough to... He rubbed the side of his face. Let's forget what looks like neuroregeneration for a second. Let's dial it down. Ambulation on its own seems really problematic. Yeah, that was my first reaction too, Janice said. I will note that his muscular recovery has conformed to a more typical pattern since that initial burst. For the most part, he requires crutches now, as we're starting to rebuild strength in PT. I suppose one possibility is that an adrenal rush in that moment allowed for an unusual degree of muscle contraction. An extraordinary degree, said the orthopedic surgeon. I wasn't there in the parking lot, said Janice. So I can't say with certainty how long he stood or how many steps he took. This was self-reported. But he was able to walk at your consult 5 days later, unassisted? He was, she said. With difficulty, but yes, he walked. The audience chewed this for a while. Is there any chance we're looking at a somatoform disorder here? A conversion disorder? Someone asked, raising the possibility that Cameron's paralysis had been psychological, a type of mental disorder, that he'd converted psychological trauma into physical symptoms, and that the only thing that had been preventing him from walking since 2010 was his mind. Janice shook her head. The etiology of the SCI was organic, she said. That's evident in the imagery. This wasn't psychogenic. And dermatome tests, someone else added, would seem to rule that out. But is it possible, I'm just riffing here, is it possible the physiological damage wasn't as severe as the initial presentation suggested, if you factor in the overlay of somatoform? You've got penetrative spinal trauma with a patient exhibiting a corresponding lack of motor function. It's easy to imagine his attending physician at Landstuhl thinking, well, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Again, I think we can see it clearly on the scans, Janice said. It is a duck, or was. Somatoform, though, that could potentially explain the sudden ambulation, said the orthopedic surgeon. If his leg muscles had stimulation or some movement in his sleep over the years, he shook his head, grimacing. Maybe, I don't know. But aren't we ignoring what appears to be axonal sprouting? Someone else said. That seems to be the elephant in the room. Somatoform can't account for those MRIs, folks. But clerical error can, someone said. An SCI with an overlaying somatoform disorder plus a scan mix-up, said another. Isn't that pushing coincidence to its outer limits? I'm more comfortable with coincidences than with miracles, the orthopedic surgeon grunted. I'll second that, Janice said, a moment later realizing she'd unwittingly endorsed the somatoform disorder theory, which she found wholly unconvincing. What about infectious discitis? Someone else asked. This was a penetrating wound. As you can see from the imaging, Janice replied, clicking the remote, There's no indication of any epidural abscess, no indications of effusions.
And we evaluated spinal fluid?
We did, Janice said.
Can we go back to that study for a moment?
Someone asked.
What's the rate of conversion from Asia B to E? I'm curious. Is there one?
Janice clicked the remote a few times. About 1%, she answered.
Huh,
came the response.
So if there was some degree of sensory function present, and he was misclassified, maybe we're not entirely in uncharted waters.
Based on the study parameters, yes, possibly. Dermatome test results can be variable, even within individual patients, but we should note that at Landstuhl, Brook, and here, he never scored above zero, not once.
Have we trended electrolytes? Someone said. I might be grasping at straws, but hell, I guess we all are.
This went on for another 15 minutes, with Janice finding herself increasingly isolated on stage, as certain theories gained backers and alliances started forming in the audience. Somatoform versus abscess versus Asia misclassification versus clerical error versus what an anesthesiologist deemed shit happens.
I did a residency in pathology before switching to anesthesiology, he explained. And in pathology, we sometimes had to say, excuse my language, shit happens, by which we meant the precise cause of death just couldn't be determined, not with precision. Maybe there's a corollary there.
The orthopedic surgeon, with a teasing grin, swiveled around to say,
Bill, I can't think of anything more terrifying for a surgeon than to hear an anesthesiologist uttering the phrase, shit happens.
Above the resultant laughter came Dr. Turnbull's croaky drawl.
I hate to spoil all this fun here, folks, but I'm afraid I gotta cut this off, he announced. I'll grant this is fascinating stuff, but we could hash it out till the cows come home. I think we should all thank Dr. Cuevas here for the excellent and very unusual presentation.
All eyes were pinned on Turnbull now, since custom was for him to have the final word on case presentations. And with anything but cardiac cases, to which he often dispensed granular-level opinions, this final word tended toward coach-like platitudes. He cleared his throat.
The purpose of these lovely conferences, as we all know, is to evaluate care quality to determine whether there's room for improvement. So let's ride that pony. Anyone got a thought as to how we might have achieved better care efficacy here? Or what we can do better for this boy going forward?
No one said anything.
If we look at this from an outcome-based perspective, he went on, and I think we should, I'd have to say this appears to be a successful damn case. This boy came into our care as a paraplegic, and during his care here, regained full function in his lower extremities. I'd say he hit bingo. Anyone care to argue that definition of success?
Again, no one said a word. Scattered shrugs were all.
Now, Bill, he said to the anesthesiologist with a touch of mock sternness, there's another way you could have put that, sentiment from pathology. It's the way my mama used to put it. The Lord does work in mysterious ways. God happens, came the anesthesiologist's rejoinder.
This time it was Janice's voice cutting through the laughter.
With all due respect, sir,
she said to Dr. Turnbull, perhaps more icily than she intended, the Lord actually works in predictable ways. Anxious expressions in the audience alerted her to how insolent this might have been received. And when her gaze returned to Dr. Turnbull, she could see this was the case. Below his combed-back white hair, his face seethed with the redness of a lobster splashing into boiling water.
I realize the cases on y'all's schedule today might not be as interesting as this one, he announced.
His eyes pegged hard upon Janice.
But neither are your patients as healthy as this boy seems to be. So let's go give the rest of them our best effort, boys and girls. Let's try to get them all to hit bingo.
As the audience members began standing, Dr. Turnbull stood up and announced,
One additional note, folks. Can y'all listen for a second? There's obviously a great deal of press interest in Dr. Cuevas' case, so let's make sure that everything that you've heard and said in this room stays right here. The usual protocol remains in effect. Everything goes through public affairs. Everything.
his face still flushing, he shot a quick glare at Janice, who'd briefly, and she'd thought benignly, appeared on a Fox News segment after getting ambushed outside the hospital.
Thank you all for your attendance.
And with that, Dr. Turnbull left, so swiftly that Janice was forced to abandon her laptop on stage in order to pursue him. She did stash her iPhone, still recording, into her lab coat. She squeezed her way through hallway discussions of Cameron's case, one of them intriguingly heated, and trailed Dr. Turnbull's white coat out the door. A cooling bay breeze was drawing patients and visitors outside, and dozens were lounging and smoking in the circular courtyard that Dr. Turnbull was bisecting. Most of them congregated around a fountain in the middle. The courtyard had just been restored after hosting construction equipment for 2 years for a $304 million expansion of the GCVHCS campus, still ongoing, that Dr. Turnbull had helped shepherd through congressional thickets. The hot, drowsy summer had been hard on the newly planted grass. Only a few green tufts were struggling upward. Dr. Turnbull must have heard Janice's heels clicking fast and insistently behind him, because he turned to face her just before the fountain, without her calling his name. Flatly, he said,
Dr. Cuevas?
I didn't mean any disrespect back there, she said.
For a marathon runner, she was oddly out of breath.
I'm sorry if my comment came across that way. By predictable, I meant, I guess, explicable. That a positive aberration is still an aberration and warrants further study. It felt like you gave that short shrift, sir. To me. I'm sorry if I'm being too frank.
Janice hates this tendency of hers to over-apologize. She and Knapp still laugh about the time he pointed it out to her, and she immediately apologized for it.
But I think this case deserves more.
Dr. Turnbull ran a hand through his hair and scanned the courtyard before he spoke, nodding amiably to a patient rolling by in a wheelchair.
Do you know who called me last week?
Janice shook her head.
Sir?
Secretary McDonald did, and Senator Burr, too.
He was referring to Robert A. McDonald, who just 2 months before had been confirmed as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, the ranking member of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He lifted his heels to slightly raise himself, as though to emphasize the importance of these calls.
And do you want to know what both of them said to me? Larry, I don't know what y'all are doing down there. But whatever it is, keep doing it.
Janice shook her head, opening her mouth to speak.
Now hold up. Let me just tell you what I told them both. I got me one hell of a fine doctor on my staff, name of Janice Cuevas, C-U-E-V-A-S. I appreciate taking the call, gentlemen, but all the credit goes her way.
I'm honored, sir, Janice said, genuinely. But you know that credit isn't mine. All I did was read the same newspaper they did.
Pursing his lips, Turnbull vented a long sigh through his nose. Maybe you need to be looking at this another way, he told her. That boy of yours, once he's out of physical therapy, hell, the next time you see him might be for his flu shot next year. Benchmarks don't get higher than that. That's a success, Dr. Cuevas. That's as good as success gets around here.
But it's not our success.
Is that what this is about? Whose success this was or is?
I'm not quite following you, sir.
Look, you've got a lot of patience, Janice, he said. You're clocking so many goddamn hours that our contract docs are about ready to see your head on a platter. Those patients, all of them, they're your focus. You really want to take hours away from them to figure out why this one boy managed to switch his transmission out of park?
If this was a mystery illness, Janice said coolly, I imagine you'd have a different take.
Damn straight I would. But it ain't. It's a mystery recovery, and I'll take 10, 20, 100 more of them today. Look at these men out yonder.
She steeled herself as Dr. Turnbull placed a hand on her shoulder to pivot her toward the fountain.
I'd like nothing more than to see every one of them jump out of those chairs and walk off this campus. Hallelujah and pass the peas. Every one of them.
But don't you see? She said. If we can pinpoint what happened, then maybe we can determine if it's reproducible. We didn't even get to potential drug reactions back in there, or whether axonal regrowth could have been...
We're not a research institute, Janice. And writing papers, that ain't your job.
I'm sorry, sir.
There she went again.
But
did you forward his case file up to Washington?
Just like you said. And I also sent it up to the CFNN in Providence, she said, referring to the VA's Center of Excellence for Neurorestoration and Neurotechnology, a research laboratory.
Then let's let them work their magic.
Sir, this is my patient, and I feel an extraordinary obligation to him, and to my other patients like him, to—
Now hold right there, Dr. Turnbull said.
And Janice did, waiting while he sighed and glanced about the courtyard with a distressed, even pained expression, his face reddening once again. When finally he spoke, it was in a lowered voice, a muted baritone hiss.
Let's just get to the nub of this, okay? Has it crossed your mind that you might have missed something along the way?
Absolutely, she said, though without much confidence. I thought that was the point of me presenting the case this morning. I thought we were making progress until you cut it off.
And therefore it's possible,
he continued, as though she hadn't answered,
that this boy spent 4 years suffering in a wheelchair when maybe he didn't need to.
He raised his head and tightened his eyes as though assessing a suture he'd just made. Realizing she was out of breath again and gasping lightly, Janice said nothing.
What if it turns out a 2-week course of clindamycin could have had him up and out of his chair 4 years ago?
Sir, she protested, there's been nothing to suggest infection.
Tell me which headlines you prefer,
he said. His face was back close to hers now, his voice tuned to a growl.
The ones we got now, or ones that say, VA miracle turns out to be VA mistake?
Now it was Janice's turn to tighten her eyes.
You don't actually think this is a success, do you?
What I think, Dr. Cuevas, is that the deeper you look into this, the greater the risk that you're going to find something you wish you hadn't.
She tilted her back.
Then that will be on my shoulders, won't it?
Yeah, he muttered. Don't I wish.
He took a step back from her so that his face was no longer in hers, and she could no longer smell the coffee on his breath. The smoke from a newly lit cigarette came drifting over from the fountain, and still short on breath, Janice suppressed a cough.
What I think, Dr. Cuevas, is that the status quo is the very best case scenario for everyone involved. You and your patient included.
Chapter 7. Call it prophecy, coincidence, or the routine exuberance of a mother's love. Cameron Harris's mother, Debbie Ann Harris, née Crawfords, sometimes referred to her son as her miracle baby. This was because his entrance into the world, the raw fact of his existence, defied obstetric opinion. Or at least the opinion of one obstetrician, hers, who following Tanya's birth told Debbie she was unlikely to bear more children. No one recalls precisely what the medical hindrance was. Something about her uterus, her tubes, according to her sister Belinda. But Debbie's miracle tag for the infant Cameron is a memory set in concrete.
I reckon every mama thinks her baby is a gift from God, says Belinda. But Deb, she was sure of it. Cameron was like a fortune cookie from on high. He spun her life around 180 degrees. She wasn't big on church and all that until he came along. Fact, she was pretty wild in her younger days. She and old Sneed used to throw down pretty hard.
Debbie Crawfords met Sneed Harris during her freshman year at Biloxi High School. Sneed was 2 years ahead of her, a thick-necked, blue-eyed linebacker on the Indians varsity squad, known for his toughness, his fuse-free temper, his Kawasaki motorcycle, his fondness for mixing high-proof Everclear with beer for what he called sneedy snacks, and for being the only student at Biloxi High with a shaved head. The shaved head was to disguise a case of very premature baldness that, according to family members, resulted from a bizarre medical condition. While he was playing in an uncle's barn as a child, a hayseed fell into Sneed's dirty ear, sprouted, and grew into his ear canal, eventually requiring surgical extraction to relieve the pressure. Family members cite this as the cause for his baldness, as well as for his violent bent. Debbie's family, the Crawfords, has been on the Mississippi Gulf Coast for generations, its men mostly shrimpers, as her father was. Sneed Harris was a transplant from Stone County, in the piney woods above the salt line, an immigrant from the hard-scrabble, hard-luck inland. Rufus Little Harris, Sneed's great-great-grandfather, was a Confederate deserter from Missouri who took refuge in remote Stone County to avoid being hanged for desertion, but died in prison anyway after shooting a preacher 6 times in the back for sheltering his beaten wife. One of Rufus's 4 sons, Fant Harris, was shot by a black sharecropper while having intercourse with the man's 13-year-old daughter. Fant survived long enough to organize the sharecropper's lynching, but died shortly thereafter from infection related to the gunshot wound. This legacy of violence and imprisonment went trickling, and occasionally gushing, into subsequent generations. Cameron's grandfather, Randall Polk Harris, served 4 years in the state penitentiary at Parchment for beating a used car salesman with a tire iron before stealing a 1955 Chevrolet Nomad. One can find it difficult, reviewing the Harris's ancestral rap sheet, to avoid hearing the echo of William Faulkner passing judgment on his notorious Snopes's. A family, a clan, a race, maybe even a species of pure sons of bitches. But Debbie didn't see it that way, not at the age of 14 when she met Sneed, nor even at the age of 28 when he abandoned her for good. "She loved him like crazy," says Belinda, who was 18 months her sister's junior. "Oh, don't get me wrong now, them two was constant drama. Up and down all the time, breaking up and getting back together. That was pretty much every weekend. He'd cheat on her, then she'd cheat on him, and some poor guy'd get his ass whipped, and then they'd be together all hand in hand like nothing ever happened, 2 teddy bears. When she was with Sneed, she was either crying tears of joy or tears of grief, hardly nothing in between." Following high school, when Sneed took a job as a derrickman on an offshore oil rig, and Debbie started working as a nurse's aide, their relationship appeared to smooth out. Or at least, Sneed's long absences eased the abrasiveness. "They'd throw these big-ass parties when Sneed would come back from the rigs," Belinda recalls. "About as wild as you can imagine. Next morning, there'd just be beer cans and bodies on the floor, and God help me, Sneed and Deb passed out buck-naked in a corner with these big, dumb grins on their faces." One effect of those nights, aside from the grins, was Debbie's unplanned pregnancy with Tanya. "I'll say this for Sneed," Belinda says. "He went down on his knees proposing the moment he found out he was going to be a daddy." They were married on February 27, 1985, 6 months before Tanya's birth, and honeymooned at a Texas hunting ranch where Sneed's cousin worked. A year later, they bought the house in Reckonford Avenue, and settled into what no one describes as marital bliss. "He'd hit her sometimes," says Belinda's husband Bill. "I know that because he told me so, one of the times they come visit. I wouldn't say he bragged about it. It was more like he thought he was giving me advice. Like if 2 guys are bass fishing and one says to the other one, 'You know, man, if you let them topwater lures rest a bit before you get to reeling, you'll probably get more strikes.' That kind of tone. Sort of like, 'Here's something that works for me.' I don't recall what I said back to him, but I can tell you it wasn't what I should have said. I never wanted nothing to do with him." But Debbie did, despite everything. Tanya, who'd endured 6 years with her father before he left, saw things differently. "Daddy coming off the rigs wasn't ever a good thing," she recalls. "Mom'd go crazy cleaning and primping and cooking and talking about how good everything was going to be. But it wasn't good, not one time. Because you knew he was going to blow up, but you never knew when or why or what for. That's how she told it to me. He'd start hollering at the TV news because they put a black weather girl on there. 'Now I got to listen to a nigger telling me it's raining.' Or freaking out on Mama for letting me eat steak on account of steak's too expensive for kids, and him saying how fat I was anyway. I didn't cry a single tear when Mama sat me down and told me he wasn't coming back from Texas, not a damn one." Sneed Harris had taken an oil field job in West Texas, a 12-month contract gig,
paying him twice what he was earning offshore. Over the course of his first 3 months in Texas, his phone calls home gradually petered until his final call, when he told Debbie he'd met another woman and wasn't coming home. "I remember the show Full House was on the TV when she was telling me," Tanya says, "and something on that show making me laugh right after Mama stood up, and her throwing this look back at me and saying, 'Girl Bunny, you understood all I just told you, right?' And me saying, 'Yes, ma'am, I sure as heck did.'" By this time, Cameron, the miracle baby, was 3 years old, a whirligig of toddler energy. Debbie reconnected with her Catholic faith after Cameron's birth, believing that with her son she'd been divinely accorded some sort of second chance, that from her womb had emerged not just a child, but a set of personalized commandments. She feared this newfound piety, however, might have alienated her husband and factored into his leaving. "His people was hard-shell Baptists," explains Belinda. "They thought Catholics drank blood." In the immediate wake of Sneed's desertion, Debbie set aside religion to take a back-first plunge into depression, dropping into a year-long emotional coma. "I took care of both of them, really," recalls Tanya. "Mama couldn't cook, so I cooked. Mama couldn't get Cam dressed, so I did. That was me yanking off his wet pull-ups. Mama'd cry, and Cam'd cry, and I'd be switching back and forth between them, holding them, telling them it was going to be all right." So this was how Cameron Harris grew up, with two kinds of mothers, a phantom of a father, several years of maternal weeping jags, and an infinite amount of fried oysters. "My mama taught me to fry oysters when I wasn't even tall enough to see over the stove," Tanya says with a laugh. "Dixie Seafood used to be across from where the Busy Bee is, so I could always get a jar. That's all Cam would eat. I'm serious. They was like chicken tenders to him." Despite this deep-fried, cornmeal-crusted diet, Cameron grew up lean and lithesome, with delicate, doll-like features. Debbie Harris, everyone agrees, was a looker. Her sister claimed she was a ringer for the model Cheryl Teagues. With beach-blonde hair and spacious, searching, Delft blue eyes, plus a pair of narrow, elongated legs that could so powerfully distract men that, the story goes, they were once the cause of a gnarly water-skiing accident. And Cameron clearly favored her. "The memory of mine that's most vivid," says Mary Annie Fillingame, Cameron's third-grade teacher, "is how beautiful a child he was. I don't think I'd seen a prettier boy in all my life. You know, he had that terrible fall the year I had him, when he cut his little cheek. I remember him coming in with all the bandages and me thinking, 'Of course, oh, that poor child,' but also thinking, 'My stars, that perfect face, that poor perfect face.'" Tanya, by her own vinegary admission, took after her father. His lumpy linebacker's figure was hers from birth. Instead of the bouncy gold curls of her mother and brother, Tanya was endowed with a head of coarse beige hair she likens to badger fur, in which gray streaks started appearing during puberty. Her body reacted to heat not just by sweating, but by breaking out in vast pink continents of hives, a liability for Gulf Coast summers. Her flat feet made her waddle like a duck. If any of this ever distressed her, however, Tanya doesn't show it. From an early age, she equipped herself with the armor of self-deprecating humor, insulting herself before anyone else could. In grade school, she invented a character she called Fat Sally, pulling a pair of pink tights up to her chest and pretending to hunt for cake, and with acid cheer, she would volunteer to be a human shield during dodgeball games. She didn't lack for friends, but popularity wasn't a goal of hers. While other kids were gathering after school, Tanya was making a beeline home to help raise a baby. Debbie was working nights as a nurse at the Merritt Health Hospital in Biloxi. She and Tanya traded shifts taking care of Cameron. For a while, Tanya had a boyfriend in high school, a Russian-born adoptee named Oleg, who played cornet in the marching band and death metal guitar in his bedroom. Oleg was a spindly, tiny boy, barely 5 feet tall. As an orphan in Russia, Tanya says, he'd been severely malnourished, making them an incongruous-looking couple. A card he once gave Tanya bore an illustration of Winnie the Pooh and Piglet holding hands, which he annotated by drawing an arrow pointing from Piglet to the word me, with another arrow connecting Winnie the Pooh with you. Whatever Oleg's intent, Tanya interpreted it, heart-stung, as a depiction of their physical pairing, the lopsided way they must have looked walking hand in hand through the school hallways. Following their breakup, Oleg wrote her a long and sentimental letter in which he thanked her for, among other things, teaching him how to be a man. Here was something else Tanya didn't know how to interpret. Maybe he meant she'd shown him the proper way to kiss a girl, and what to say to make a girl feel special. But then she'd also taught him how to chug a beer, bait a fishing hook, and change a flat tire. So she wasn't sure. Cameron, entering middle school at this time, had grown into a happy, engaged, even irrepressible boy. His sights were set on becoming an actor, and he went so far as to take after-school acting classes in Gulfport, where he appeared as Fiedka in a production of Fiddler on the Roof. Along with his best friend, Bucky Petz, Cameron made movies using Bucky's VHS camcorder. They christened their partnership CB Productions and dedicated every film to the memory of Cameron's dog, Lucky. Tanya starred in one of these movies as the victim of a sand monster slowly consuming her into the gut of Biloxi Beach. Despite the years separating them, sister and brother were never far apart. Their inchoate selves seemed nurtured and secured by the other's presence, symbiotically linked. Tanya had a television in her bedroom, and many nights would find her and Cameron curled together in its quivering silver glow, Cameron usually drifting off to sleep beside his sister, most nights, according to Tanya. When nightmares struck, or when the passing trains rattled him from sleep, it was in Tanya's bed that Cameron sought refuge. Highlighting Tanya's role risks diminishing Debbie's. Debbie worked long hours, and the stress of single parenthood left her brittle at times. But tenderness was never in short supply. Tanya and Debbie confided in one another. The first person to whom Tanya reported her first kiss, from Oleg, was her mother. And Tanya was Debbie's sounding board for conflicts at work, and later for thoughts about her dating life. Together, almost as partners, they fawned over Cameron. Like all children, Tanya and Cameron didn't lack their mild traumas and troubles. Debbie's temper, prefiguring Cameron's, could spontaneously combust. Her children now laugh about the way she'd sometimes hurl a flip-flop at them when angry, about her gunslinger's adeptness at removing the sandal and firing it their way in a single smooth stroke. But it wasn't likely a laughing matter then. Money was always tight in the Harris household. For as long as they can remember, the ringing telephone was ignored until the answering machine could confirm that the caller wasn't a debt collector. Cameron, like his sister, struggled mightily with schoolwork, and while Tanya seemed immune to social cruelty, Cameron's awkward exuberance made him an occasional target for bullies. In seventh grade, Bucky moved to Florida. The loss of his best friend struck Cameron hard, as all losses seem to do, and he has never, to this day, fitted anyone else into the best friend slot. He tended, like his mother, toward emotional extremes. When his dog Lucky broke loose and the 8-year-old Cameron found the dog's crushed body at the side of Division Street, he cried for 3 days straight, stranded far beyond the reach of any consolation from his mother and sister, marooned on an island of terrible shrieking grief. He was also, Tanya says, prone to overthinking, to pondering choices, even minor ones, to the point of anxious immobility. "You know how you get a gut feeling about something and just go with it?" she says. "Cameron never seemed to have that. He still doesn't. He just chews and chews things in his head until there's nothing left to chew." Cameron's adolescence coincided with what might be called his mother's second adolescence. After years of moping about Sneed's abandonment, followed by years in which she threw herself into the church, and with Cameron outgrowing his need for her attention, plus her transfer to the hospital's day shift, Debbie Harris decided it was time to try dating. "She had to been lonely," says Tanya, who helped her mother craft her first online dating profile. "Dinner'd be cleaned up, the laundry all folded, and Cam and I'd be back in my room watching TV. I reckon she didn't feel there was a whole lot left for her at night, and maybe she'd finally gotten Daddy's poison out of her system." The effect of this, for Cameron,
was that men started coming around the house in Reckonford Avenue. Lots of them, though never for very long. Donna Arlott, a co-worker of Debbie's at the hospital, observed this period in their life. Deb went on dates a lot, but I don't recall her ever going past a fourth or fifth, she recalls. Heck, I set her up on a few of those. Honestly, I don't think she knew what to do with a decent guy. You gotta remember, Sneed wasn't just her first husband. He was her first boyfriend. Her first and only everything. So she didn't know what love was. She didn't know it didn't have to be torture. I'm guessing a lot of those men found themselves very confused after a few dates with Deb. Ingratiating themselves with Cameron was a common maneuver for these men. They took him fishing for croakers at the harbor, rowed him around on their boats, taught him how to hit golf balls at a driving range, threw catch with him in the front yard. One of them, a highway patrolman, let Cameron fire his service revolver at a hunting camp up near Jackson. This patrolman, according to Tanya, was also in a way responsible for Cameron's high school football career. Apparently unimpressed with Cameron's visit to his hunting camp, he expressed concern about Cameron's manliness to Debbie, just as Cameron was about to enter Biloxi High School. He told Mama he thought Cam was a little weak or something, Tanya recalls. Told her the best thing she could do for him was to get his scrawny self onto a football field. Debbie Harris didn't think enough of the patrolman to continue dating him, but pricked by his comments, and perhaps suffused with nostalgia for Sneed's old glories as a varsity linebacker, she did defer to his counsel. That summer, she convinced Cameron to try out for the junior varsity football team. Cameron was nothing like his snarling, thick-necked, bruise-dispensing father. He was slender and lissom, and he carried himself nimbly and elusively, less like a bull than a deer. "So an ideal wide receiver," says his former coach, Tom Bud Niekase. "I saw it that first tryout clear as day. He had good straight-line speed, but you put him on a route and he could run it like nobody's business. He just had these superb instincts. To be honest, after just a few weeks in, I was figuring him for a future college ball player. I really was." As Cameron was embracing football, furiously studying the game in order to catch up with teammates who'd been playing since grade school, and spending long, grunt-filled hours in the weight room, Debbie was finally embracing one of the men she'd met online. Jim Yarbrough was recently divorced, with three kids of his own, and had served in the Navy during the first Gulf War. Jim had a modestly dangerous side to him. He was a professional poker player, which seemed to satisfy Debbie's appetite for a bad boy. But Jim was good to her, and for the first time since Sneed Harris bolted to Texas, Debbie's friends and daughter saw her illuminated by love, or something close to it, discerned a newly honeyed melody in her voice. She and Jim attended every one of Cameron's games together, except when Jim had a conflicting poker tournament, and on military night at Harrison Central High School during Cameron's sophomore year, Jim Yarbrough was among the veteran parents lauded on field at the halftime ceremony. This was by Cameron's request. He liked that Jim didn't use him to peacock for Debbie, didn't drag him fishing or golfing or boating or shooting. Jim had his own kids to tend to. What Jim did best, in Cameron's eyes, quietly, even wordlessly, was to respect Cameron. With a poker player's intuition, he seemed able to read precisely who and what Cameron was, zeroing straight into his essence without objections or judgments, and with an easeful tolerance for adolescent muddles. It helped, too, that Jim had played community college ball. His post-game commentaries on the drives back home were always filigreed with fresh insight. By the end of his second JV football season, Cameron's talents were glittering. The first time his picture appeared in the Biloxi Sun-Herald wasn't after his recovery at the Busy Bee. It was after a winning game against D'Iberville High School, the camera catching Cameron in soaring flight above three hapless-looking defenders. His mother had the newspaper page framed, and with great ceremony hung it in the living room. Cameron was a lock for the next season's varsity squad, and in the spring, Coach Niekase dropped by the house to talk about the college recruiting process with him and Debbie, and to leave a copy of the NCAA Guide for the College-Bound Student-Athlete. He'd already mentioned Cameron to Coach Cutliffe up at Ole Miss, he said, and he'd gotten an unsolicited feeler from the receivers coach at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
I was seeing a bright, bright future for Cameron, Coach Nikkei says. That boy had some hellacious legs under him, some real speed and agility, and a set of big soft hands that the ball loved sticking to. The hours he'd put in the weight room, too, and out on the track, he had the drive. I'd say the only thing he lacked was confidence, but we were making headway with that until the tragedy with his mama.
At this, Nikkei sighs, and with a sour, deflated expression, shakes his head.
That pulled the rug right from under him.
On June 17, 2004, at around 4:30 p.m., Debbie Ann Harris was driving in the right eastbound lane on Interstate 10, just past the exit for the Bernard Bayou Industrial District, when an 18-wheeler from Texas, estimated later to be traveling more than 80 miles an hour, plowed into the rear of her Honda Civic without braking, as though oblivious to her. The impact launched Debbie's car into the center median with the 18-wheeler hurtling close behind. The truck flipped, its cab sliding sideways into the westbound lanes, and its trailer capsizing onto Debbie's accordioned Honda. Debbie was pronounced dead at the scene. It can seem like a small and ugly point, the truck's origins, but it's one Tanya nevertheless dwells upon when talking about her mother's death. Because the truck and its driver hailed from Texas, Tanya sensed and still senses her father's invisible hand in what happened. As though 13 years after wounding Debbie with his desertion, and just as she was beginning to realize how nourishing life could be with a kind and decent man, Sneed Harris had dispatched that 18-wheeler to finish her off for good. Cameron took the news, which was delivered in that tightly knit way of small towns, by the same highway patrolman who dated Debbie and triggered Cameron's football career, by holing up in his room for 24 hours, weeping so hard and ferociously that Tanya, perched outside his door, feared whether it was possible to sob oneself to death. Then he emerged dazed and red-eyed into the living room, smoked half of one of Tanya's cigarettes, and holed up for another 12 hours. When he came out the second time, Tanya says, he came out different. He come out broken, she says. Cameron played 3 games of varsity football that fall, tying a school record for the most receiving yards in a single game in the season opener against St. Martin before quitting. We tried everything we could to turn him back around, the coaching staff and his teammates and all his teachers, Nikkei recalls. We told him how much it had meant to his mama, what it meant for him going to college, everything. But nothing got through. He just kept saying he was done. Perhaps a longer stretch of stability might have assuaged some of Cameron's grief, might have remedied some of that brokenness. Maybe time could have resurfaced him. But 14 months later, as he and Tanya, who was 18 when Debbie died, and living at home while working at a Dollar General store, were still struggling with the fallout from their orphaned existence, Hurricane Katrina came uncoiling off the Gulf. The scant solidity they'd been able to piece back together got smashed by the 28-foot storm surge that went sloshing out to sea. After the hurricane, Cameron went from broken to shattered. The once irrepressible boy seemed wholly vanquished from his being, replaced by a dejected, glowering, slouch-backed young man who seemed unwilling or unable to reflect upon anything more than the cigarette smoldering between his lips and the hammer in his hand as he cobbled their ruined house back together alongside the church volunteers from Indiana. After the volunteers would leave for the day, he'd sit chain-smoking in the twilight backyard for hours, amid stacks of new lumber and piles of molded, pulpy drywall, staring at the debris with a dark and vacant countenance, as though his heritage had caught up with him, and he'd submitted to wearing the same blank expression his Stone County ancestors had accorded the rear flanks of mules while plowing furrow after furrow after furrow. Nothing could cheer him. Nothing could even shake him. Tanya tried. She tried fishing out the artist brother of hers, who'd so joyfully and nerdily engineered her consumption by a sand monster. Tried fishing out the supercharged athletic dynamo who'd been on track to be the first of Rufus Little Harris's descendants to attend college. Tried locating that single sand grain of exuberance, that must surely have been lodged somewhere inside him, resistant to the hydraulic force of his despair. But long gone were the days when she could pull him to her chest to let him soak her t-shirt with his tears, when she could silence his crying by humming Madonna songs to him while rocking him in her big, lush arms. And Tanya was swamped with struggles of her own. In the course of 14 months, she'd lost her mother, her home, much of her hometown, and her job. All that remained of her Dollar General store after Katrina was the foundation slab. And she was watching her brother be hollowed out by anguish, was watching that once bright future of his being erased like chalk off a chalkboard. A cigarette was about all she wanted to reflect upon, too. Cameron graduated from Biloxi High School in 2007, just barely, and without the varsity letter in football that had once seemed the most token of his destined honors. Afterward, he zigzagged through a series of construction and post-Katrina cleanup jobs, cash gigs for some of the out-of-state contractors that descended upon the coast. Many of his co-workers were itinerants from Mexico, and sometimes he'd hang out with them at their trailer parks, drinking cut-rate tequila while they laughed and argued in Spanish. Occasionally, Coach Nikase called to check in, as did Debbie's old boyfriend Jim Yarbrough. But unless Tanya was home, these calls perished in the answering machine. Not that Tanya was home all that often. She'd taken a waitressing job at Waffle House, one of the first businesses on the beach to reopen after the hurricane. And with the job had come a new social circle of co-workers, a raggedy bunch. After a while, she stumbled into a low-grade romance with a cook named Durnell, who went by the nickname D-Light. What D-Light liked most was to spend 4 or 5 frenetically sleepless nights in New Orleans' French Quarter, alternating hits of crystal meth with a local drink called a hand grenade. By the second day, swatting constantly at a set of imaginary bongos, and by the third day, running out of bars that would serve him. Tanya couldn't stand the meth. Not the high itself, which incinerated all her desolation in a white-hot burst of euphoria, and for the only time in her life, made her feel sleek and invincible. But instead, the bleak, interminable come-down, and the unbearable way she'd grind her teeth while using, leading to throbbing jaw pain that only exacerbated the come-down. Usually she'd bow out after the second or third day, retreating to the back seat of D-Light's parked car, where she'd dose herself with Xanax and half-sleep for long, miserably cramped stretches. Sometimes, she says, D-Light would venture out to check on her, poking at her limp body with the tip of his boot, but usually not. One time she staggered from the car to a tattoo parlor on Frenchman Street just to feel someone paying close attention to her. It was after one of these trips to New Orleans, early in 2009, that Tanya returned to Reconfort Avenue and noticed a stack of folders, brochures, and official-looking paperwork piled atop the kitchen table. She lit a cigarette and edged herself blearily toward the pile. She eased open one of the folders, lifted out a form, and for a long while stared at it. "Cam?" she called out, to no response. "Cameron!" But she didn't need his confirmation. Trembling in her hand was a DD Form 4-1, a signed contract. In the middle of a goddamn war, her baby brother had gone and enlisted in the army. Chapter 8. Among the many other curious visitors to the Busy Bee in the weeks following Cameron's recovery was a 34-year-old Catholic priest named Adolf Bosa Chukwura Nkemdiche. In his native Nigeria, he was known as Father ABC, but Mississippians had pruned that down to Father Ace. Quinn was away that morning, making his weekly run to Louisiana to buy lotto tickets. So Father Ace obtained the information he was seeking from Hat. Then he walked down Reconfort Avenue to the Harris House and rang the doorbell. Father Ace is the pastor at Our Lady Queen of Angels Parish, 4 blocks west of the Busy Bee on Division Street. Such a slight distance away that it didn't occur to the priest to drive. Queen of Angels, as it's known, is the smallest parish in the Biloxi Diocese, with a congregation of just 93 families. By contrast, its parochial neighbor to the west,
Our Lady of Fatima Church boasts 1,700 families. It's also the poorest parish in the 17-county diocese, with annual collections insufficient even to fund maintenance on the 83-year-old church building. So poor and so small, in fact, that after Hurricane Katrina ravaged the church, the diocese secretly considered shuttering it. Since his appointment as pastor in 2011, however, Father Ace has engineered something of a comeback, adding 20 families to the congregation, renegotiating the parish's debt with the diocese, and ministering to his parishioners with a stamina that's tiring merely to observe. There's an athleticism to his efforts that he comes by naturally, having been an all-star soccer striker in his youth, and then briefly, until suffering an on-field injury that left him with a permanent limp, a member of Nigeria's national under-17 team. When he scored, 60,000 people would belt out the chorus to the Jackson 5 song ABC. And the memory of this spreads an unsaintly smile across the priest's face, ignites a twinkle of dormant ego in his eyes. The sound that buoys him nowadays is the non-stop vibrating of his cell phone, its hornet buzz usually signaling someone in need, of a ride to work, of bail money, of an emergency babysitter, of help fending off an eviction. The age-old metaphor of a shepherd and his flock feels inadequate for how Father Ace operates. He is more like a cowboy, galloping hard to drive his herd forward, hooting at the stragglers, lassoing the wayward, moving them on, and heading them up. His face glossed with a perpetual sheen of sweat. The rumor, which the priest denies, though he's flattered to hear it, is that he sleeps only 2 hours a night. Some of his parishioners, especially the older ones, credit Queen of Angels' reinvigoration to Father Ace's doctrinal conservatism. He has revived bygone rites and rituals, the solemn benediction of the Blessed Sacrament, novenas, meatless Fridays, and from the pulpit, frequently inveighs against the cafeteria-style attitudes of many American Catholics. Many of his instructors at Enugu Memorial Seminary in eastern Nigeria were elderly Irish missionaries, and their pre-Vatican II orthodoxy he readily absorbed. The mercies he extends to his parishioners, almost hourly, stop short at theology. Sins, he forgives. Doctrinal dissent yields a whip-cracked rebuke. It's a conservatism he wears quite literally on his sleeve. When Tanya Harris opened the door, she found Father Ace dressed in his standard throwback garb, his body draped in an ankle-length black cassock, and his clean-shaven head capped with a stiff, black, three-peaked beretta. She needed no further information to conclude, "Reckon you'd like to talk to my brother." By this time, 12 days after Cameron's recovery, the doorbell was becoming a familiar sound, ringing with almost cuckoo clock regularity. First had come the reporters in a triplet of waves, the local and New Orleans press first, then the national press, brusque and skeptical, and then, to Tanya and Cameron's bemusement, the international press, some from Asia, but most hailing from Latin America. "Miracles lead every newscast in Chile," the cameraman explained to Tanya. "Miracles and UFO sightings." After that had come an intermittent but now increasingly steady flow of what Tanya was calling the randos. Little old ladies bearing chess pies or deviled eggs, peering past Tanya for a glimpse of Cameron. A group of 7 Mexican men timidly requesting to touch Cameron's legs. Cameron allowed this, but admits it was flat-out weird. And people in various shades of distress asking for Cameron to pray with them, which invariably he did. They sat beside him on the couch and held his hand, or more frequently his knee, often in front of a video game paused on the flat screen. He didn't know what to do when they wept. "Don't bother to stand," Father Ace said when Tanya led him to Cameron, who'd begun to rise from the couch. But then the priest changed his mind. "Actually, I might like to see that." When Cameron did, the priest crossed himself and issued a quick and whispery prayer. Cameron was used to this by now. His physical therapist occasionally did the same thing. Tanya sat beside Cameron on the couch while the priest introduced himself and the reason for his visit and took a chair. He asked, "Have you spoken to any clergy?"
We had this Baptist preacher come by, Cameron answered, and Tanya nodded. You know that big new church up there on Big Ridge, across the bay? That's the guy. I don't think he liked I was drinking a beer.